Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hine, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome to the Global Compassion Summit, everyone. My name is Emily Hine, and it's my honor to be your host for this inaugural online compassion event. Before we begin, I want to mention that this Compassion Summit came together in part as a birthday gift to the Dalai Lama, who celebrated his 80th birthday on July 6th. The Dalai Lama has said that compassion education is the key to keeping the compassion momentum going and the compassion movement going, and that compassion is essential to creating a more peaceful society. He has actually inspired me to work for compassion, and I'm so grateful to the many sponsors and speakers who also gave their time freely so that this summit could occur. Over the next 3 days, our speakers will be offering compassion education to give you a sense of what compassion really is, and they will provide inspiration, real-life examples of how they have put compassion into action in their own respective ways. And finally, we will provide ideas for how you can take compassionate action in your life and enjoy a life filled with even more love, more happiness, more kindness, and of course, more compassion. So let's get started. It's very rewarding for me to introduce our first guest for the summit, Dr. James Doty. When the seed of the idea for the Global Compassion Summit came into being, Dr. Doty was the first person I approached for ideas and support, and you'll soon learn why. James Doty is the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, also known as CCARE, at Stanford University. In fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the founding benefactor of CCARE. Dr. Doty collaborates with scientists from a number of disciplines examining the neural basis for compassion and altruism. He is also a professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's an inventor, an entrepreneur, and a philanthropist, and supports a number of charitable organizations supporting peace initiatives and providing health care throughout the world. Dr. Doty serves on the board of many nonprofit organizations, including the Dalai Lama Foundation and Tulane University School of Medicine. He serves on the senior advisory board of the Council for a Parliament of the World's Religions, and he's on the Global Compassion Council for the Charter for Compassion International. Dr. Doty, thank you for saying yes to the Global Compassion Summit, both by committing CCARE as a lead sponsor and by personally donating your time for today's talk. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. I think this is just a wonderful program that you're doing, and I'm really happy to participate.
Thank you. Well, it wouldn't be complete without you and with CCARE involved, and I'm particularly excited about our session today, which is on the science of compassion. Really, who better than a neurosurgeon to help us understand the neuroscience behind why compassion is critical to our health and well-being. So, Jim, if we could, let's start with some basic questions and relate it back to our biology. Why should I be compassionate?
Well, it's an interesting question because it's, you know, really a fundamental question, because to be compassionate actually requires you to commit resources, time, and effort. And unless there is some sort of, frankly, payback to you, why would you do it? Now, that could sound very sort of self-serving. But that being said, the amazing thing about compassion, and in fact the Dalai Lama actually said it best, is when you are one of the only opportunities where it's okay to be selfish is when you're compassionate to others. And the reason is because the return to you in regard to your health, both mental and physical, as well as even your longevity, are profoundly, positively affected by being compassionate.
Well, can you say a little bit more about that? So specifically, how does it benefit our health?
Well, let me give you a little backstory to explain why we as humans have this essentially a hardwired aspect to our neurofunctioning and our peripheral physiology that makes us want to be so. And that relates back to our evolution as a species. To acquire what is termed theory of mind, where we recognize that others have independent thoughts from us, to have abstract thinking and complex language required significant enlargement of our cortex. It also required that, unlike other species, our offspring are absolutely needy of our care because they require care, resources, energy for a decade and a half to even 2 decades, in my case, maybe 3 decades, with my daughter, but regardless, a child requires that they observe, that they mirror behavior, that they are taught, and to have all of that happen so that they learn how to be a functioning human being and survive independently of their mother, the mother has to give immense resources. And unless there was something that came back to her and made her want to care, our offspring and our species would not survive. And that is translated actually into very strong neural pathways and neurotransmitters, one of which many of us are aware of, called oxytocin, but there are others, in which when a child is in need or is suffering, if you will, and remember the definition of compassion is recognizing the suffering of another and a desire to intervene, when your offspring are suffering, there's an incredible desire and motivation to care because of the release of this oxytocin, which is an incredible motivator of affiliative behavior, or what some people say, love. And when that hormone is released, it also gives you a sense of calmness, a desire to care. It lowers your blood pressure. It makes you relaxed. And it makes you desirous of spending the time caring for another. So it is a genetic imperative, if you will, for us to care. It is really our default mode. Now, as we evolved from the nuclear family surviving in a very harsh environment to the hunter-gatherer tribes, which until 6,000 to 8,000 years ago was our primary mode of survival, in groups of 10 to 50, we also had to use the same neural pathways of having the ability to recognize another suffering. Because in these small groups, if someone was suffering, that potentially could result in putting the group at risk. Because if someone is suffering and not being able to live up to the social responsibility of the group, then the entire group is at risk. So we have these innate components which allow us to read another's behavior, and also this incredible desire to care for those who are our kin and kith, if you will, our family, or those within what we define as our group. And these are very, very strong bonds. And I give the example of your partner walking into a room, and they don't have to say anything, and essentially instantaneously you can tell what their mood is, if they're in pain or if they're hurt, and you have this desire to respond. That is an innate part of our humanity. Now, what has happened, though, over time is that as we went from this hunter-gatherer tribe to the development of culture, society, religion, and the domestication of animals and plants, it allowed us more leisure time and more thought, if you will, but it also created situations where sometimes the needs of just living, especially in modern society today, distract us from this sort of default mode that we have, because another aspect of our brain function and our physiology is our sympathetic nervous system, which is in very fine balance with our parasympathetic nervous system. The release of these affiliative hormones, such as oxytocin, or when these pathways of affiliative behavior get stimulated, it actually increases the tone of the parasympathetic nervous system. And when that happens, again, you become relaxed, you become calm, and in fact, it promotes creativity, it promotes being more productive, versus when your sympathetic nervous system, which many of us know as our flight or fight mechanism, when that is engaged, you shut down. You are closed off to interaction oftentimes. You're scared. Your blood pressure goes up. Your sphincters tighten. Your pupils dilate. And you are not necessarily thinking clearly, because the only thing you're thinking about is survival. And these compete against each other. And it is when a person is in this position to care for another that it can downregulate the sympathetic nervous system and increase parasympathetic nervous system tone and get all these wonderful benefits, which are the opposite of the sympathetic nervous system, which is your blood pressure lowers, your pulse rate goes down, your immune system is boosted, you are more creative, you're more productive, you're more thoughtful, and you actually think much more clearly. So there's sort of a balance to all of this, as you can see, and you can hopefully see the evolutionary aspect of why this developed in relationship to those characteristics that are most associated with us being human.
And so what this says to me then is that when we engage, when our sympathetic nervous system is engaged in that fight or flight or sometimes freeze mechanism, one of the perhaps counters to that would be to actually be of service to somebody, to go into compassionate action. Would that then kick in the parasympathetic nervous system, or does the parasympathetic nervous system have to be kicked in before one has the ability to be compassionate?
Well, they sort of are acting together all along. But as an example, we know that oftentimes when people are depressed, what happens is they close themselves off from others, they ruminate about negative thoughts, and actually it, in a profound way, affects their physiology or physiologic function in a negative way. We know, though, that when they reach out and connect with others or be of service to others, this actually can decrease symptoms associated typically with depression or depressive behavior, and actually mitigate that. Because when you're not thinking about yourself and you're thinking about others, as you noted, it does kick in this effect on the parasympathetic nervous system. And the exciting thing that we know is that we can actually train people to be more compassionate, and by doing so, maximize their genetic potential for being compassionate and reap the physiologic rewards from that.
Well, you've teed us up for a beautiful question, and this is something that C-Care specializes in, which is compassion education. Can you talk specifically about compassion trainings that C-Care manages, oversees, offers, that can help an individual become more compassionate?
Well, first of all, let me backtrack a little bit and say that we know, and I'll give you one example, that people do have a genetic potential for being compassionate or acting compassionately. As an example, there are people who have a certain type of oxytocin receptor, which actually does not work as well, if you will, compared to another type of receptor. And the people who have that receptor, which, if you will, functions better, if I can use that term, are actually much more open, inclusive, kind, and much more able to be compassionate. And in fact, this is also demonstrated in the world of rodents with voles. There is one species of vole which is monogamous and which is very caring. And then there's another in which the male is not monogamous in any way, shape, or form, and essentially goes here and there to different partners and is essentially not involved in any type of long-term relationship. And fundamentally, it is about their genetic expression of these receptors. We also know that there's evidence that if you want to look at the spectrum of compassionate behavior, on one end are people who demonstrate sociopathic, narcissistic, or psychopathic behavior. And we now realize that those individuals often can be identified at a very young age, as young as 4 or 5, as having these attributes or characteristics because it is an expression of their genes. We also know there are individuals such as the Dalai Lama or Nelson Mandela or others who have this very natural characteristic of being compassionate. And the reality is most of us are in between and probably on the lower end of in between. But we know that when you use certain types of mind training, that you can actually make one more compassionate, maximize their genetic potential. And what happens is not only does it have a significant positive effect on their physiology and even the length of their telomeres, which translates into increased longevity, but it has a profound effect on everyone around them. We know, and I'm sure you know yourself, that you can see a person who walks into a room and who creates a fearful environment, is not particularly kind, and what happens? Everyone shuts down, and they don't communicate, and it's very tense and upsetting for many people. While the opposite type of person can walk in, has a smile on their face, greets everyone, body language is saying that they're open and receptive, and the entire environment in the room changes because that person has, if you will, compassionate behavior or attributes which makes people feel like they're cared for, like this person wishes to be their friend, and therefore that allows them to be that way. And it's a rippling effect. There have been studies that have shown that when an individual does a compassionate act, it has a significant effect on those around them, making them much more likely themselves to commit a compassionate act or be more compassionate and reap, again, the physiologic benefits of that behavior. At SeeCare, what we have done, knowing this, is that Thupten Jinpa, who formerly was a Tibetan monk and remains the primary English translator for the Dalai Lama and also has a PhD from Cambridge, he developed with our team at SeeCare as a visiting scholar a secularized compassion mental training that combined with input from PhD psychologists has shown itself to be a very powerful technique to increase one's compassion and, again, reap the very positive physiologic benefits. And both anecdotally as well as formal research studies have shown the positive benefit of this. Other laboratories and research facilities have also demonstrated that even with as little as a few weeks of a compassion training or practice, that it can have a significant effect on your immune system, your physiology, and those markers that we associate with stress in terms of decreasing those markers.
And so if somebody wanted to participate in the CCT program, I'm blessed to be one of those who has. Maybe you could let our listeners know how they can get involved and take that course. And we'll come back to this towards the end of the interview as well, but since it's been brought up, let's go for it.
Well, I would suggest if anyone is interested in the work that we do, they visit our website, which is ccare.stanford.edu on your browser. And on that website is not only a listing of the literature in this domain, as well as videos of a number of talks and conversations relative to this domain, but the research that we have published and information regarding our compassion cultivation training program and its availability in terms of schedules and locations. We also have, as you know, a compassion cultivation training, teacher training program, where we actually train individuals to give the compassion cultivation training, which is an 8-week program of a commitment of 2 hours, 1 day a week, and then a period of 20 to 30 minutes of meditation daily. We have now instructors who are all over the world and are giving this training. And on our website are the schedules of those individuals as well as the training programs we do in Stanford or at Stanford and in the local vicinity.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you mentioning that, you know, early on in the call, because I think it's important for people to recognize that, you know, compassion as a concept is, you know, it can seem so big. And then when you hear somebody like you, Dr. Doty, talk about the neuroscience, people can start to get intimidated. Like, how can I, you know, participate in compassion and take compassionate action and change my own physiology as well as impact the people in my life? So I think it's important early on for us to help people see that actually with training, compassion can be cultivated and it can be, it can happen as quickly as an 8-week course. And so really appreciate you bringing that up. I wanted to ask you about another element of compassion that seems to come up a lot in the course itself, the CCT course, which I'm also certified to teach now, so I get a lot of questions about this, and that is about self-compassion as an element of compassion. Can you talk about self-compassion and why it might be important for us to embrace and how we can do that?
Well, it's interesting because this idea that people would not be potentially compassionate with themselves is somewhat a phenomenon of the West. And in fact, in conversations with the Dalai Lama early on, he was surprised that this is even possible. But the reality is that for reasons that may have to do with Western culture and the fact that oftentimes it is very rushed and people don't feel as connected, oftentimes individuals are hypercritical of themselves and beat themselves up, and in fact they're the last person that they demonstrate compassion towards. And one of the challenges is that when someone is repeatedly telling themselves that they don't deserve love or kindness or being cared for, it is very difficult then for them to be able to give these types of feelings towards others. And so what has been found through the work of a number of scientists, pioneered by Kristen Neff, is that by giving people a set of tools, and this is an integral part of the Compassion Cultivation Training Program, giving them a set of tools that allows them to be compassionate towards themselves, then releases them to be compassionate towards others around them. And it's really can be quite profound when you see the light bulb go off in an individual who has not had awareness or insight into how hard they're being on themselves. Remember, the reality is that each of us is a frail, fragile being. And oftentimes, who is fearful of the future or the uncertainty of the future? And also, when combined with the fact that in modern society, Western society, you don't have the closeness of family that you do, as an example, oftentimes Asian cultures, where your brother, your sister, your grandparents, your in-laws are in close proximity who know you. So if you were suffering or having some issues, you can immediately communicate with them. So when you are sort of isolated from those who naturally give you love and who accept you always, no matter what you've done, it's often very difficult to be kind to yourself. So once that light bulb is lit, suddenly you realize that not only is it wonderful to be kind to yourself, but in fact you deserve it, and then this releases you to be much more caring towards other people.
Wonderful. I'm very, very happy to hear you bring up Kristen Neff's work as well. She is a wonderful contributor to this Global Compassion Summit, and for those of you who are listening in for the full 3 days, you'll hear a great talk with Kristen Neff as well on self-compassion. And her study is really pivotal to much of the compassion training that's out here, including the CCT program that Dr. Dodi just spoke about. Let's shift gears just a little bit. I continually think about this Global Compassion Summit and how it can impact other people. You know, people who might be accessing compassion for the first time, trying to figure out how they fit in. And I think about you, Jim, and I think how, you know, you're such an accomplished neurosurgeon, and I really doubt that you're lacking for things to do. And so what really inspired you? You know, why is compassion personally important to you? You know, what was that initial seed of compassion that turned your heart, your energy, and your skills towards compassion?
Well, I appreciate that question, and I think that it's not that no one or that individuals don't have the capacity for compassion. Everyone does. Unfortunately, sometimes by an individual's circumstances, either they have not been dealt with in a compassionate fashion and as a result are deeply suffering and may have significant anger as well, or they haven't understood how powerful compassion can be in terms of your own happiness and making others around you happy. And it's by being compassionate and being of service to others that actually allows you, frankly, to have a full and meaningful life. Getting back to your specific question, my background is one where I grew up in poverty. My father was afflicted with alcoholism. He was often unemployed. My family was on public assistance essentially my entire life at home. Neither of my parents had gone to college. My mother was an invalid. She had had a stroke and was partially paralyzed, and she also had a seizure disorder and was chronically depressed and actually had attempted suicide multiple times. So it was not necessarily an ideal environment to thrive. And it's not because my parents didn't care about me or love me. It was just that when you have parents who have their own afflictions and are dealing with them, they don't necessarily have time for anything else. And as a result, it was a very chaotic, difficult childhood. And it, even at a young age, I was aware of the paradox between individuals who had capacity, resources, be they financial or position or influence, who would see people suffering and not intervene. And already at that young age, from my own suffering, I knew what it was like to suffer, as well as the joy when someone would reach out and help you. And it, the paradox was that you see the individuals I just described to you who at times would do nothing for you, even though you desperately needed help. And then individuals who really had nothing themselves and were suffering and who would immediately reach out and embrace you and try to alleviate your suffering. And it was that paradox that stayed with me throughout my life. The other aspect of this is that when I was 12, I walked into a magic shop, and the owner was not there, but his mother was there. And she knew nothing about the magic store per se, but she did understand people. And after a conversation with me, and she asked some very penetrating questions, she actually reached out to me and told me she was going to be in the area for the rest of the summer, and that she could teach me some things that could change my life. And what she taught me was a mental training practice, or a meditation practice combined with the visualization technique and, if you will, the power of positive thinking. And what I tell people is, prior to that, I felt like a leaf being blown by an ill wind with few, if any, possibilities. And following that, I felt as if I had unlimited possibilities. And it was that singular interaction with this person that really was my first experience with neuroplasticity, changing your brain. Because after that interaction, I thought anything was possible. And that training she gave me, and that belief in myself, and that change in perspective is what allowed me to go to college, medical school, become a neurosurgeon, become a professor at Stanford, become a successful entrepreneur of a company that went public for $1.3 billion, and also to essentially give all that wealth away, recognizing that that money could be of service to others, and in fact that my life could be of service to others, realizing that by doing so, that ultimately is what gave meaning to one's life, and ultimately, at the end of the day, what most of us are striving for is to be able to say that my life had meaning, my life had purpose, and the world is a better place for me being here.
Mm. Wow, I just want to take a pause here and really thank you for sharing your personal story. We all have a personal story, but often, Jim, I think when people see somebody like you, they think, oh, you know, he's probably always had it easy. He's always been smart. He's always been supported. Look how successful he's been. And when you share that story, it becomes pretty obvious that, you know, you didn't have that support. And as you said, you were like a leaf blowing in the wind. And the compassionate intervention, if you will, of this kind person in the magic shop turned your life around, gave you tools, gave you love, compassion, and specific tools for you to change your life. And what you've done with it is extraordinary. So, you know, just thank you. Thank you for sharing the story, and thank you for using the adversity that you were given and turning it into something incredibly positive that has been really of great service to compassion.
Well, you know, as you point out, all of us have backstories, and sometimes people do think that their own situation is so bad that they may not be think that they can turn it around. But I submit to you that one can, and one can change the way they see the world. And the choice is up to you. You know, it's interesting because you can see two people who experience the same thing and the profoundly different reaction to that event. As an example, you have two people who walk out into the rain. One person says, oh, my God, you know, my suit's wet. There's going to be traffic. You know, there's probably going to be a delay on my way home because of an accident. This is horrible. My whole day is ruined, and I'm not going to be able to do X, Y, or Z. You have another person walk out into the rain and says, oh, the warmth of that rain feels so good on my face. I know we've been in a drought, and this is really going to be beneficial to the crops. It's going to be beneficial, you know, for our water reservoirs, and it's going to benefit so many people. And water is what brings life to the world, and I'm thankful to be alive. Now, both of those individuals have just experienced the exact same event. And it's not the event, and philosophers have said this more eloquently than I, but basically it is not the event per se that is an afflictor of one. It is how they respond to the event. And the choice of how we respond is up to us.
What I think is it Shakespeare that says it is not good or bad, it is thinking that makes it so? Something to that effect.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. And so this is one of the wonderful things about compassion training. It changes how you perceive the world, and it also allows you to not necessarily respond to the negative conversation that oftentimes is in our head, and ultimately it allows you to change the conversation and make it one where it is not hypercritical, it is not negative, it is supportive, it is nourishing, and it gives you a well of resources that allows you to respond to these adversities in a way which is positive and allows you to be an example to others. And so it's a wonderful thing. You know, sometimes people think, wow, you know, there's so much suffering. I have all these things on my shoulders. There's no way that I can really help anybody because I'm just one individual. But there is not a single thing that has been accomplished in this world that has not been done at the start by one individual. You know, there's an interesting saying that I believe is from Africa, which is there is this fire in the forest, and all the large animals such as the giraffes and the lions and the elephants are on the periphery, and they've run out of the forest, and they're standing on the periphery, and they're watching the forest burn down, and they look up, and they see a hummingbird, and the hummingbird is flying out of the forest to a lake, filling its beak with water, and coming back and dropping the water, this drop of water, onto the forest fire. And they say to the hummingbird, why are you wasting your time doing this? It's not going to have any effect. And the hummingbird says, that may be true, but I'm doing what I can do.
That's beautiful. Speaking of you doing what you can do, what compelled you then to start Seek Care, the Center for Compassion, Altruism, Research, and Education at Stanford?
Well, it's interesting because I am asked that, and all I can tell you is that periodically, you know, I've been affiliated with Stanford since 1997, and I have come and go, sometimes do entrepreneurial activities, sometimes do other things. But I had left, and I decided to come back in 2007, and Stanford has really been wonderful in allowing me to have a significant degree of freedom in my academic career. And when I decided to come back, as soon as I came back, this whole issue of why people are or are not compassionate struck me, and it also interested me is how is this expressed in the brain, and what is the value proposition of being compassionate? And what I did when I came back was I actually just began talking to scientists in the neurosciences and in psychology at Stanford, and gathered a small group of individuals together to have conversations about this. And I have to say that initially there was not a whole lot of interest. But I'm a fairly persistent guy and a eternal optimist. I convinced a group of people to begin what we initially called Project Compassion. And then I funded some initial research studies, and people started getting excited. And then I was walking through the campus one day, and again, it just popped into my head, wouldn't it be interesting to have the Dalai Lama come to Stanford and speak about compassion and interact with these scientists? And it was interesting because I am not a Buddhist. I have no religious attachment, and I didn't know a whole lot about the Dalai Lama other than that he was an icon of compassion. Why that popped into my head, I cannot tell you. But that thought then resulted in me arranging a meeting with him. And I asked him if he would consider visiting Stanford. He had visited twice previously. I told him what work I was doing and initially engaging in terms of research and compassion. And His Holiness immediately agreed. And I was really quite overwhelmed because, first of all, being in the presence of someone like the Dalai Lama is extraordinary because you're just bathed in this sense of acceptance and unconditional love. And, of course, you know, he's known throughout the world, and is probably one of the most famous, well-respected individuals in the world. So it was really an amazing experience. And after, as our meeting was ended, his translator, Thupten Jinpa, began an animated conversation initiated by His Holiness in Tibetan. And I was sitting there actually thinking, oh my goodness, have I actually pissed off the Dalai Lama? And I'm like getting a little anxious. And at the end of their dialogue at Tibetan, Thupten Jinpa turns to me and says, His Holiness is so moved by your commitment to this work that he wishes to make a personal donation. And His Holiness at that first meeting made the largest donation he had ever given to a non-Tibetan cause to initially fund this work. And he became our founding benefactor. And again, talk about overwhelmed with emotion and responsibility. It was amazing, and he has continued to be very supportive of this work, and has since that time engaged in support of our work and visited us at Stanford multiple times, and remains committed to supporting our work. It's just amazing. And soon after he gave his donation, two other individuals became our initial founding patrons and ongoing supporters. And that is what allowed us to create SeekCare, which is part of the School of Medicine at Stanford, and also an affiliate of the Neurosciences Institute at Stanford. And we have a multidisciplinary group of scientists who work not only across the university and the School of Medicine, but also in a variety of disciplines, looking at a lot of research questions in regard to this topic of compassion, altruism, and how it can have a positive effect in your life, and in regard to mental and physical health, in regard to longevity. Additionally, what we do as part of C-Care is that we not only support research, but interventions such as the Compassion Cultivation Training and others, and then we also have a lecture series, and one of the things I enjoy the most, we also have something called Conversations on Compassion, where I invite individuals, be it from the scientific world, the business world, the world of humanities, or the spiritual or religious world, to come and sit on a stage with me for an hour and a half and just have a conversation about how compassion has personally affected them, what the path was for them seeing the importance of compassion, and the impact it is in their lives and the lives of those around them. And it's really just a wonderful series, and all of those can be seen on our website.
Well, Jim, you've really given a comprehensive overview of C-Care, and I really appreciate hearing the story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama and how moved he was by the efforts that you were making, so much so that he made the largest contribution that he had made to date. That is incredibly impressive. And it seems as though he gets around, as you know, and he also influenced me in taking the CCT program and then becoming a certified teacher when we hosted him in Seattle for an event called the Seeds of Compassion. We had 150,000 people who were all dedicated and coming to the events, and I asked His Holiness, what can we do to continue the compassion movement? What is the number one most important thing that we can do? And he said to me, compassion education. Interestingly enough, that day on the stage, Thupten Jinpa was right there, and I didn't know that years later I would be taking the course that that Jinpa had created through your program at C-Care. So it's beautiful how this all comes full circle and how there are many avenues of being called into compassion. And just, you know, human being to human being, I want to thank you for following the calling that helped you create C-Care, get the support that was necessary, and follow kind of both your intellectual brain as well as your heart to manifest this in the world. Now, all that said, if you could wave a magic wand from that magic store, in 5 years from now, you know, really using kind of the same techniques that you were taught, visualization and positive thinking, in 5 years from now, what is the ideal vision for compassion education, compassion research? What would you hope that you and others, myself included, what would you hope that we'll all be able to realize in 5 years around this whole beautiful topic?
Well, what I tell people is that fundamentally, for our species to survive, we have to have a compassion revolution. And we need each of us to be a soldier for compassion. And the reason is that if you look at every domain of our life, being it our inner life, our individual functioning, being compassionate, as I've indicated to you, has a profound effect. If you look at the educational system, integrating compassionate behavior, there's preliminary evidence that this has a significant effect on violence in schools, significant improvement in attendance, and in academic performance. So we know that mind training in this area can have a profound effect. But then if you look at business, there's an ever-increasing body of evidence that when a corporation, if you will, acts compassionately, both from the top down and the bottom up, whereby there's transparency, there's cooperation, there's open communication, and meaning is given to the work that individuals do, it has a profound effect on shareholder value, productivity, and profit. If you look at the healthcare system, and we have just done a review of how kindness and compassion affect health outcomes, there is no question that when individuals are cared for in a more kind, compassionate way, it has an effect on the healing of disease. in terms of shortening the duration, decreasing the severity, and improving the outcome. And I tell my residents, and even though I'm a neurosurgeon in a very technologically sophisticated area, my success is equally due to my being kind, compassionate, and caring to my patients. In terms of the social justice system, it is my belief, and I think it is a reality, that most of the people who are incarcerated, they are not there because they are evil, because they are bad. They are there because fundamentally they have not been shown kindness, nurturing, and love. And study after study has shown that when you make the effort to give people tools to be more compassionate, when you treat them with dignity and respect, they ultimately themselves can reach their potential as a human being. If you look at civic government, and an example of this is the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, who has taken it upon himself to imbue the entire city with this idea of compassion in all levels of how the city functions. It is having a significant effect, and in fact, there is now a compassionate cities movement, the charter of compassion is soldiering forward, and mayors of various cities are seeing how compassion can have an impact on their citizenry for the better, incorporating into how the police function, and God knows we need that when we look around and see the various atrocities that have happened. When policing has become an us-against-them proposition, where it has become militarized, versus showing care and compassion to individuals and recognizing their dignity. So in every domain of life, compassion has a profound effect. And as I said, it is my belief that when we have a compassion war, where we are, each of us is working toward being more compassionate, being a soldier of compassion, if you will, creating a revolution of compassion, it is at that point where we will reach the pinnacle of our potential as a species, and it is ultimately what will make our species survive into the future.
Wow, I could embrace and get behind that vision. So I appreciate all that you have done to spell that out so beautifully across sectors. And I think we're getting close to the end here, Jim, and so I just want to ask you one last question, which is, given everything that you've talked about, a bit of the science and the research and the education and the compassion conversations, everything that feeds this pool of compassion, do you have any final suggestions for our listeners about any additional ways that they might embrace compassion in their lives?
Sure.
Small steps are big.
First of all, I tell everyone, regardless of your position in life, regardless of your financial situation, each of us has the capacity to be kind to one person every day and change their lives. And it can be the smallest act, such as simply saying hello. So each of us has the ability to positively affect another individual every day, at least one person. The other thing that I have incorporated as a practice of my own that keeps me centered as a human being and as a physician is a mantra that I use, which is made up of 10 letters of the alphabet. And I, with intention, go through this multiple times a day to set my intention to act in what I believe the correct place. And those 10 letters are C through L, starting with C, being compassionate towards self and others, D, recognizing the dignity of every person, E, practicing equanimity, F, practicing forgiveness. You know, people, when they're angry and upset at another, it basically emotionally puts them at a standstill where they can go no further. It is only when you forgive someone that allows you to go beyond that hurt. People will say, in fact, it's like taking poison, somehow thinking it's going to affect the other person. We know that practicing gratitude, has a profound impact on your level of happiness. So often people are looking at what others have than being thankful for what they have. Because frankly, especially in the United States, we are better off simply being in the United States than the vast, vast majority of people in the world. H is for humility, recognizing that you cannot be of service authentically unless you look at somebody in the eyes at the same level. You are not above them. Each of us is struggling. Each of us is a human being. And it is only with humility that you take on this task of being of service. I is having integrity and personal values that you live by, that guide you. J is for justice, this concept of social justice and caring for those in society who are most vulnerable. K is kindness, which is the active component of compassion. And L, of course, is love, of which contains all of this.
That is beautiful. I think it's a great place for us to end our talk today. Thank you so much, Jim. It's really been an honor sharing this time with you today, and I just want to thank you for your heartfelt professional and personal commitment to bringing more compassion and altruism to our planet. You and really the whole SeaCare team and all the teachers and extended staff and volunteers are really making the world a better place. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Emily, for doing what you do. I appreciate it, and I have the greatest respect, and thank you for asking me to participate.
Absolutely. And just a couple small announcements for people before we end this session. If you are interested in learning more about Stanford's SeaCare program, including the research, the upcoming compassion events that Jim hosts, where to take the 8-week compassion cultivation training course, or how to find a CCT teacher near you, please go ahead and visit ccare.stanford.edu. And I just want to thank you all for listening to this very informative and inspiring discussion with Dr. Jim Doty. Please be sure to join us for the next session of the Global Compassion Summit. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.